My name is Dawn, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. It's a privilege to be here. It's always a privilege to share the good news of daily recovery. I want to thank Rick and Carrie for picking Kelly and I up at the airport. That was just a great trip. It was a great trip from the beginning, getting at the airport, and I was sitting in the seat, and this young woman, two seats over, leaned over and said, "Are you Dawn C?" And I said, "I am." And she said, "I'm scared." It's going to be okay. It's just going to be okay. You know, I think when you get my age or when you've lived long enough and you've had certain experiences, it's just going to be all right. It doesn't matter what it is. It's going to work out. You know, it may not work out the way I want it to work out, but it'll work out. And it will be for me and for us a learning experience, you know. So I'm real grateful. That's the end of my talk. Thank you. I used to like to, you know, start my talk talking about the alcoholic and his drinking and his negativity and his character defects, which I could list very clearly. But about 20 years ago, and you will notice this, let me tell you this one. Years keep running together. And I'll say 20 years ago, it may have been 25 years ago. I don't know, you know, may have been last week. No, but, well, you know, I just, the years have passed, and they just get mixed up for me. I don't think I'm suffering from any something yet, but by the same token, I just get the years mixed up. But it was around 20 years ago, maybe a little more than 20 years ago, our youngest child was having a problem getting his life together. And we took him to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said that she'd like to talk to Peter and myself, Peter being my husband. And so we went in to see her, and she said, "I want to know what type of parenting you each received." And my husband said, on a scale of 1 to 10, I received a 0 or a 1. And she looked at me, and I was sitting there in my Al-Anon self-righteousness, you know, little halo over here, you know. And I said, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, I received an 8 or a 9. And she said, you're the problem. No one who received an 8 or a 9 would marry someone who received a 0 or a 1. I remember going home, and I called up my sponsor, and I said, let me tell you what she said. The lady's no good. We're not going to go back there anymore. Yeah. And she said, Dawn, remember some things I've been saying to you these years? And I want to say that because some people come in this program, and it takes them a long time to get the program, and we get restless with them. And we say, oh, you know, they ought to know by now. Years I had been sitting in those rooms. No one ever asked me. When Kelly talked last night, when I was 7 years in Al-Anon, I was a babbling idiot. No one asked me to speak. I thought they thought I was deep because after I said something at a meeting, they said, honey, you keep coming back. And I said, they really like to hear me talk, you know. But I was born in a parsonage. This is my story. I was born in a wonderful parsonage. My father pastored a little church in Flint, Michigan. Every time my mother had a baby, every time my father built a church, my mother had a baby. So my mother had 8 children. I was the last of her 8 children. By the time after I came along, we moved to Detroit, Michigan, and my father bought a church, so they no longer had churches, so I guess they stopped having babies. I never quite understood that. I'd like to ask, but it's too late. The church started out with 300 members, and by the time I was just a little tyke, this is in the 40s, they had like 6,000 members. It was a gigantic church. My father was an eloquent preacher. I would sit at my father's feet and listen to him preach any given moment. There just was, I loved to hear my father talk. The problem was, They were busy doing God's work. And they had, Mama lost three children before I was born. She lost three babies, one at 9 months, one at term, and one at 7 months. She never talked about it. Never talked about it. But what she did was distance herself from us. It was like we never hugged, we never touched. When they were going on a trip, we might get a peck on the cheek. I think now, looking through a spiritual eye, my mother was deeply depressed. She lost three babies. I've had children. I know what it is. And that's the home that we grew up in. Now, wasn't that bad, though? Let me say this. My problem in that home, too, was my mother turned my care over to my grandfather. And my grandfather, who I loved, sexually abused me until he died. And he died when I was 7 years old. And so at 7 years old, I thought I was the biggest sinner in the world. My father would open the doors of the church, and every Sunday I came down and joined. Every Sunday I got on my knees and asked God to clean me up, and little children are not dirty. And I was not responsible for what happened in that situation. But I carried the scars and the guilt of it through most of my life. Another thing, I had these brothers and sisters who were very interesting. My oldest sister, who was my role model, I thought she was dynamite. The truth of the matter is, she was thin. Anyone who was thin was my role model. Okay. My sister, I watched her disposition and how she dealt with men. And I said, when I grow up, I want to be like her. She was 13 years my senior. Now, the problem was, my sister was a schizophrenic. I don't think it's a good idea for a kid to pattern their life after someone who hears voices, you know. So if I tell you that I heard a voice this morning that said so and so, I'm just trying to be my sister. No, the truth, I thought my sister, I remember the night she was going to get married, the day before, and this fella, her fiance, came to the house, and she took all the suitcases that she was going to take on that honeymoon and threw them down on his head. And I said, isn't that romantic? Look what she did, you know. And that guy showed up at the church. That was my other role model. Then I had this other sister who did nothing. She just sat in a rocking chair. I called her the Gestapo with bloomers because she was so mean, you know. Then I had these two wonderful brothers. One who wanted to be an actor, but you can't be an actor if you're in a parsonage. So he decided he would go in the ministry, and he would preach these great sermons. I just loved to hear him preach. He was nutty. He was just way out there. I remember people would call my dad, and they'd say, you know, we saw your car parked out in front of a bar. And my dad would say, no, not my car. Not my car. And he'd call my brother in. My brother would say, I was in there trying to save souls. Then I had this other brother who wanted to be a jazz musician. But you can't be a jazz musician if you're born in a parsonage. So my brother would play. My brother, I love my brother. My brother had a speech impediment. And he decided that he would learn how oratory. And he would give poems and different things up to church. The problem was, right in the middle of the poem, he would start stuttering. And a poem that would have taken 2 minutes took an hour. And we would just sit there and just cheer for him. Come on, Benny, you can do it. Come on, Benny, you can do it. He decided maybe he shouldn't do that. So he continued playing his piano. We would sing hymns around that piano. You would think it was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Everybody in my family could sing. As soon as my father left, we'd go into Bessie Smith. We'd go into little Ella, you know, a little Sarah Vaughan, you know, little Billy Eckstein. We did it all the people that we loved, you know. And Dad would come back in and we'd go right back into those hymns. You know. And Dad would say sometimes to Mother, they're so devout. Those children are really devout. I had a personality quirk. There's Michael. I don't know whether you all know Michael, who lives in Georgia. Michael said that I am a half pint short of being an alcoholic. That my personality is just distorted. You know, that's just who I am. I remember going to church on Sunday morning, and I would carry a purse with me. And I would stand at the door of the church, and I would push the little purse out so it would be wide, and I would ask people to give me money. And people would just drop coins, didn't take pennies, I never took pennies. They would drop coins in that purse, and then I would buy friends through the week, because nobody wanted to play with me. You know, it was my ball, it was my house, it was my swing, it was my stuff, it was my dad's church, it was this and that and so forth, and nobody liked me. I couldn't understand that, because I thought I was very likable. My brothers and sisters didn't like me. I was just a rotten child, but a damaged child. So you couldn't kind of, you know, I mean, I was a misfit in school. They were either putting me in the smart class or they were putting me in the slow learner class. It was just going back and forward. I'll never forget. I always forget to say. When I graduated from high school, I had to go back. I couldn't graduate with my class. I had to go back and take gym in order to graduate. My father was the commencement speaker. And I don't know what that must have been like for him. You know, here he is motivating young children to come to their best. And there's the daughter is sitting over here because she can't graduate with her class. Well, the reason I couldn't graduate with class too was I didn't know you had to attend classes all the time. You know, I wanted to live in a fantasy world. I wanted to go to movies and, you know, I wanted to do interesting things. Like, why spend all your time in school? So I remember skipping a whole semester. Didn't get in any trouble. I just went to the movies. And I told them, by this time my father had been elected a bishop in the church, and we were supposed to go to Africa that year. And so I just told them I went to Africa. And so I remember they asked me to give a report on my travel. And I got up and said it was wet in the jungle. And sat down, you know. I had some real growing up problems, you know. Personality disorder. Then I remember I discovered I could sing. I was going to be this great singer, and I was singing at different churches and stuff. And this man who was a choir director started paying attention to me. Well, let me tell you, by this time, I was a robust young woman. My drug of choice is food. My house's drug of choice is food. My parents ate from the time, they had been poor. And by the time I came along, they were doing very well. And they ate for the years they had been poor. But nobody got fat except me. I mean, we would have dinner again after having dinner, you know. I mean, we were a dysfunctional bunch. But we looked good. My daughter calls us the fig trees. We looked like we knew what we were talking about, you know. But there was so much chaos going on in that home. This man said I could sing. And I was so excited because nobody ever, when you're grossly, and I wore glasses and I never looked, my clothes never fit. I mean, I remember putting pins to go across my jacket. My mother and father always looked nice. They were very dapper. You know, and I would look awful. Nobody paid any attention to me, but this man told me I was wonderful and I got all the solos. And on the way home from church one night, he took advantage of me. Well, I couldn't go in and tell my mother, let me tell you what happened at the car tonight, you know what I mean? So we went to Europe that summer, and my mother and father, my sister, and myself, and I realized something was wrong with me, but I was fat, and so who would know? So 9 months later, I was standing at in Women's Hospital at the admissions desk, and I said to this, I've been in labor for 2 days. And I need some help. And this man was standing next to me, and he said, I've never seen her, but I'll be her doctor. And I delivered a 10-pound, 4-ounce baby boy. And he was beautiful. You know, I never had any prenatal care. It was just beautiful. Had all his fingers. God has taken care of me in times when it shouldn't have happened, you know. And my dad came to the hospital. I remember they called him. He was at a conference in Chicago, and they called him home. And they said, your daughter's in the hospital. My dad said, my daughter's never even been on a date. You know, how could this happen, you know? And they came to the hospital, and they said everything was all right. And I was so excited to have this baby, because I was going to be Mother Superior. I was going to nurture this baby and take care of this baby. And we got to a stoplight, and my father opened the door of the car. And this woman came up, and she took the baby out of my arms and closed the door of the car, and we drove on. And I remember screaming and crying, and I remember going from church to church looking for my baby. I remember the pain and the anger at that separation. And then one morning I woke up and I looked in the mirror and I said, you know what? The only thing wrong with me is I'm fat. And I'm going to do something about that. So I found this diet doctor. And this diet doctor gave me shots and diet pills. Now they say they're, you know, amphetamines, you know. And I was hooked on them, and I was going. I was lazy. I got really energetic. I could go home, and I could do anything. I remember my mother used to say, Don, I need to teach you how to clean this and so and so. And I said, don't worry about it. I'm going to marry a poor man one day, and I'll learn how to clean then. And my mother bought it, you know, so I didn't do anything, you know. I was cleaning the house. I was doing all kind of stuff. And one day, it took about a year, this grossly obese young woman stood in front of a mirror. And I was a stone fox. I mean, I was looking good. I mean, I looked so good. My brother said I could ride in the front seat with him in the car. You know, I was looking good. Now, I'm crazy as can be, just crazy. But nevertheless, I'm looking good. And, you know, I spent a lot of my life trying to fix the outside of me, trying to look good, trying to look presentable, trying to look like there was, you know, that I'm perfect, I'm in charge of this and so forth and so on. And inside, I was this terrified child, this person who was full of self-centered fear, of rage and anger and self-loathing and all those things that go along with my disease. But I thought the only thing wrong with me was if I fixed the outside. Well, don't you know, as my son David would say, young men kept coming to call on me. Well, I was in a shock. Nobody'd ever come call on me. I remember one time my dad said, I don't like that young man's looks. And my brother said, it doesn't make any difference. He's coming to see our sister. Let him come. You know, because nobody's going to come see her. But after I lost weight, my brother's friend said, what happened to your sister? She is looking good. Well, this young guy and came to call on me. And he was pastoring a church in Pontiac, Michigan. Fine young man, really. You know, together. He had a lovely congregation, and he was doing God's work, and he fell in love with the outside of me, and he said, will you marry me? And I said, yes. Well, this other young man who was working for the government, and he was doing well. He had his own place, and he was driving a nice car, and he fell in love with the outside of me. And he said, will you marry me? And I said, yes. And then there was this other young man who had just come home from the service. And he was a little bit flaky. You know, he didn't have a car. He didn't have a job. But that meant he could spend all his time adoring me. I remember the first time I saw him, it was at his parents' house, and his mother had cooked this gigantic meal, and she brought this plate, and she put it down in front of him. And I had been on this diet for ages. And I looked at that plate, and I looked at him, and it was love at first sight. He said to me one night, standing at the bus stop, he said, Don, there's something I ought to tell you about myself. He said, I'm an alcoholic. I said, that is so romantic. You know, all your great writers are alcoholics. You know, James Ball and Hemingway, they're alcoholics. You know, that's exciting, you know. And he said the magic words. He said, I need you. I said, he needs me. He needs me. I am so happy that he needs me, you know. And then he would tell me a story about his life, and his life had been so dysfunctional. I said, this is great, you know. He had these weird parents, you know, and alcoholic brothers and sisters. This is great, you know. I mean, you know, no job. You know, I said, this is really wonderful. We're going to have a great time. My husband said, people who are romantic are people who are not in touch with reality. I was not in touch with reality, folks, you know. Before this big event took place, my mother got sick and my mother died. And it was very painful. And my father said to me one day coming home from the hospital, and he said, I have loved your mother. I have loved your mother. And he said, if anything happens, if she dies, I will never marry again. Never. And my mother died on October the 24th in 52. And my father, in November, October, in November, brought his new wife to the house. You know, I was angry. I was so mad at him. And I knew she was after his money. I mean, I just had, you know, I mean, he was an old man. My dad was 55 years old, you know. Boy, how things change, you know. My dad was an old man, and he had promised, you know. But my father couldn't deal with grief, and he ran, you know. He ran, and he married this woman, and she ended up being a nice lady. I had a lot of fun with her over the years. But I remember going to see my father. He was in Chicago at a conference, and I said, how could you do this? How could you do this? You said you would never marry again. And he said, no one hurts your mother like you did. He said, I honored her all through her life. You get your life together. So I decided that I was not going to have this woman participate in my marriage. And so I fixed her. I eloped. We went to Toledo, Ohio. Justice Bud performed the ceremony. The next day, the downtown of Toledo exploded. I've often thought there might have been some connection with my marriage to Peter, you know. We went back to Detroit, and our honeymoon was at the Barlam Hotel. And Peter bought a big bag full of German beer, and I bought a big bag full of pastrami sandwiches. And he drank all night, and I ate all night, and I was so happy. I was so happy. We both got these little weird jobs. I was working at Burroughs as a secretary, which was very interesting. I was working as a secretary, and my typing speed was 4 words. But they hired me because I was still looking good. You know what I mean? They thought I was going to be the Burroughs company. They thought I was going to integrating the company, you know. So they put me in there, you know. And I was so bad that the guy promoted me and made me the lead girl, you know. Boy, were those other women angry. I don't blame them today, you know, but I was just got to walk around. Once again, feeling entitled, you know, after all, you know, they don't realize, most of them don't realize who I am. Who I really was a grossly obese woman who wanted to get back to her disease, you know. I remember one time Peter came home from work and he said that he had left home this beautiful young wife. And who opened this door was this grossly obese, angry woman. And he said he kept looking to see, where is Dawn? And what he didn't understand was he had to love me like I was. I couldn't do it, but that was his job. And we had a whirlwind, crazy first couple of years of our marriage. You know what alcoholism is like. I didn't know that when people drank, they got drunk. I didn't know they didn't bring their check home, you know. I didn't know that Peter's lies were just, I just didn't understand any of it. His blackouts. I didn't understand. All I knew was I was home with a baby, and he was messing up. So I quit my job. That ought to make it better so I could be home, and I could depend more on him. And depending on him, there's a book. One of our Odette books talks about a woman who has her foot on the man's neck, and she's saying, why don't you get up and do something, you know? Well, that's how I was. I'm sitting on Peter's neck saying, why don't you get up and do something? And he went out one night. He forgot me, by the way, when that baby was born. He forgot I was in the hospital. I thought I was going to have to stay there and rear Lisa. But I called my father, and he sent me money so I could get out of the hospital. And Peter showed up 3 days later, and he said he was going to do something about his drinking. And so he cleaned up his own act. And so a week later, Peter left to get a loaf of bread. And 4 days later, Peter showed up at home. And this time, I remember Peter hitting his hand against the wall, and he said, I'm going to call AA. Because some 10 years before, Peter was stationed here in Georgia. And he was at Fort Benning, I think it was. And he was sentenced to AA. Now, this was Georgia in the 40s, and so they wouldn't let him in the meeting. But they couldn't keep him out of the meeting because of the traditions. So they put a chair in the doorway. And that's how my husband heard about AA. And he listened, and he was angry. And as soon as he had the opportunity, as soon as his colonel or boss or whoever it was left to go to Korea, he got out of AA. But that night, December the 23rd, 1956, Peter called AA. And two men showed up on our doorstep. Now, I had called my preacher about 3 or 4 days before and told him he needed to come and counsel us. He hadn't shown up yet. And my dad was his bishop. He hadn't shown up yet. These men showed up in less than 2 hours. And Peter, who had a quaint little habit when he would go out and get drunk, he would wet his pants. And his pants were standing in the corner. And the guy said to him, I'm going to take you to a meeting. And Peter said, that's the only pair of pants I have. And he said, if you want to be sober more than you want to be drunk, you climb in those pants and you go with me to an AA meeting. And so Peter got in those pants and he went to the old, what was that, under the bridge in Detroit, Michigan. That's where he came in. His home group was East Ferry Group. But he was so angry. But he went there, and he said as smelly as he was, people rushed up to him and put their arms around him. And Peter found his group, you know. And I was at home saying, who's going to come get me? I've been here for a week with no food, I'm angry, there's nobody to help me out. Who's going to come and be my rescuer? And Peter started going to those meetings. Now, he said that they had 12 steps, but the only steps he had to follow were the first and the 12th, because he had this intellect that was so gigantic that that's all he needed. So our home was insane. 2.5 years after that, I decided that I was going to go to Al-Anon. I wasn't going because there was anything wrong with me. I went to Al-Anon because women were calling my house, and I wanted to see what was going on down at that East Ferry group. I went to the old Han and Y. We didn't have the literature like we have now. I had this little blue book, and I read, you know, the stories about, you know, about all the steps in the book when I underlined all the places Peter needed help. And I read his big book, and I underlined all the places that I could really shape him up, you know. I had this fantasy that sometime, someplace, somewhere, Peter's going to be standing in a corner, and he's going to turn around and say, I owe it all to her. She put my life together, you know. We started that meeting, my friend and I, her husband went to the same group, and she too wanted to find out what her husband was doing. And she said to me, she said, you know what we should do? We should go to that meeting, and one of us should lay down on the floor of our husband's car and put a blanket over us. And then when they go home, we'll find out whether they fool around with any women. And I said, that's the most brilliant idea I have ever heard in my life. I said, will you be my sponsor? She sponsored me for years. We were just nutty. That was the worst group. There were about seven of us at that group. We were insane. A couple of them came drunk. I mean, we were just, but we were there every week. We were reading that blue book, and I was talking about Peter, and it was just insane. I mean, it was awful. Then some new people started coming in, and you know, in spite of us, those people started getting better. You know, not because of us, but in spite of us, people began to get better. And I grew more troubled and more troubled and fatter and fatter and angrier and angrier and full of self-pity. And my husband began to grow in his job. He went and he got a job doing some professional work and then turned around and he was doing something else that was a big deal. And the next thing I knew, he was directing one of the first HMOs in the country. He was just growing by leaps and bounds, you know. And I was just getting angrier and angrier. We had moved from Detroit to upstate New York, and we were living there in confusion. And we looked like we knew. People would call us up because we looked good on the outside. I mean, I was grossly obese, but we looked. I mean, I talk about can look self-righteous. I mean, I would look like I had the answer to your, and would not hesitate to give you the answer. You know, I would no more do that today than the man in the moon. I would just be willing to help you out. Peter was trying to save people's marriages, and ours was always on the verge of divorce. You know, we were just an insane couple. And then we went to a psychiatrist, and he said, you need to look at yourself. I picked up the 12 steps. And I remember saying to my sponsor, you know, I know I'm powerless. I know that. I said, but I got these crazy kids at home. They had grown up a little bit, you know, and they were no longer being cute for me and dancing when I told them to dance, sing when I told them to dance, you know, doing all the things that, you know, the star here, the star there. They were doing, I mean, I found alcohol in my daughter's closet. How could that happen in a sane home like we had? You know what I mean? I found a couple of little, you know, reefer things there. That's what, you know, and I said, how did that happen in my house? You know, I just don't get that, you know, because we're working this program. I don't think so. And I said, what am I going to do? And she said, like when you're on the airport, you put the mask on yourself and then on your children. So I got busy in this program. I dedicated my life to this program because I was dying. I was dying of the spirit. I was dying of the soul. I had so many unresolved issues that plagued me on a daily basis. I would hear a car door and I would say, oh, they took my baby. And here I had three babies in front of me, you know? But it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. I would see a child going to, I remember one time Lisa was going to the mailbox and an old man came up to help her and I screamed, my God, don't touch my baby. The man was just trying to help her. But I was so fearful that someone was going to do to her what had been done to me. And I started working these steps, and I saw people get well, and I came to believe that there was a power in these rooms, and I came to believe that that power in these rooms wanted somebody as broken as myself to be restored to sanity. And I got under new management. I turned my will and my life and my children and Peter and everything in my life over to the care of a higher power. And I did a fourth step over and over again. Never got it right. I just keep doing them, you know. And I keep sharing them because the older I get, more is revealed. That's what it says in the AA Big Book. And I know a lot of Al-Anons don't believe in the AA Big Book, but that's all I had when I came in here. And we've got great literature now. But that's, my husband used to say, dance with the one that brung you. You know, that's the one that saved my life, reading those messages in there, reading that outline in there, helped me to understand I surrender all, anything that blocks my relationship with God, I surrender. Be it anger, be it resentment, be whatever it is. I don't want to live like that. I remember we were living in upstate New York, and I'd been working a wonderful program, really getting myself together. And this one little nagging thing, had many things, but one little nagging thing was I was so jealous. I was so jealous of Peter. Peter was this handsome man, and women were always coming up to Peter. I don't think Peter messed around as much as I think he messed around. You know what I mean? Most of it's in my head. But I do know that he wasn't perfect, okay? A lot of people thought he was a saint. I think he was the one who kind of fostered that information. But nevertheless, he told me, he said, I have hired a new secretary. And I said, that's nice. And he said, she's an older woman. I said, that's better. And that night we entertained his staff. And this young woman in a miniskirt came up to me and said, Mrs. Crawford, I'm your husband's new secretary. And I said, no, you're not. And Peter came running over to me, and Peter said, she didn't look like that when I hired her. You know, he said, you know, overnight transformation, you know, it didn't look like that, you know. And I remember we were riding home in the car, and I was just so full of weeping. I was so angry, so full of, how could you do this to me? How could you do this? How you said she was old, and so forth and so on. I remember calling my sponsor, and she said, Dawn, get to the seventh step. You're supposed to be there. Deal. Let God deal with that anger. Let him deal with that jealousy. Because it's blocking your relationship. Nothing can flow through you because you're so stopped up. And about a month or so later, we were at a retreat, and Peter was standing in the corner talking to some young women. And I looked over there, and I didn't feel anything in my heart for Peter except love and for those young women. If God could lift that character defect, if God could lift that character defect, God could do anything for me. Because it had plagued me all my life. Plagued me. It helped me deal with this self-esteem. My sponsor said to me one day, Dawn, you need to look in the mirror every day and you need to say, you're a beautiful woman and God loves you. And I would look in the mirror and I kind of, you know, my eyes would go this way and that way and so forth, you know. But I began to do that. And one day I realized that Peter Crawford was fortunate to have me in his life. You know? I remember he said one time when we were young, he said, Dawn, if I ever make anything of myself, it will be in spite of you, never because of you. But I live to see the day when he said, what a gift you are to me. You know, what a wonderful young woman you have become. And what a transformed older woman you have become. You are growing old with grace. This program. I got to that eighth step, and I had this list that I'd had from the fourth step, and I had all these people. And you know, when you get my age, most of the people are dead. You know, those people we misused at the church that my dad grew up in, they've been dead for years and years and years. So what could I do? My sponsor said, start treating everybody with dignity and respect. Start doing something for somebody and don't tell them about it, you know. Be a loving human being, even when you don't want to be, because it's not your nature. I said, thanks for sharing. Just do it. You know, just do it. And maybe some changes will take place on the inside of you, and maybe you want to do it. You know? And then I had these children. I remember, in particular, let me tell you the thing that I had to deal with. I had this rage about my grandfather that bothered me. It was always stuck in here somewhere. And it blocked my relationship with God. And I had to get on my knees a lot. And I had to go to some SAI meetings or whatever it is and deal with some the situation of sexual abuse. I had to go and see a counselor about that because I had this rage. And one day, I realized my grandfather had been a slave and he had been brutalized in his life. And I loved my grandfather. Hated the act, but loved my grandfather. And it was like a freedom came through me, you know. And then that man who had misused me in that relationship where I'd had that baby, you know, I was so, if I could have found him some dark night, I would have found a gun and shot his genitals. No place else, and I certainly would have done it in a spiritual way. You know, but I had to pray about that because he was doing fine. I don't know where he is. He's out there. Well, I know he's dead now, but he's out there in the world enjoying himself, and I'm still with the rage. Who's suffering? I don't deserve that. You told me I didn't deserve that. And so I had to deal with that, you know. And, you know, I look at that now, and some 20 years ago, my sister said, she was very sick, and she said, this boy I adopted when he was 2 years old is your son. And I was reunited with that young man. I wouldn't have had that son. I wouldn't have had him. I have two beautiful grandchildren by that boy, you know. He's a joy in my life. We talk once a week, you know. My sister's his mother, but he says I'm his best friend. And he says he could talk to me about anything. And that's because of this program, because I don't have any answers. I just have a good listening ear. And I love him unconditionally, you know. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Then my oldest daughter, Lisa was a star. Lisa was always a star. Even when she was little, she was in kindergarten. I remember she came home, the teacher called and said, Lisa said today that she stopped drinking. And she was in kindergarten. He said, and the teacher said, I don't understand. And I said, why did you say that, Lisa? She said, well, the doctor said I was allergic to orange juice. Other kids would play house. My daughter would play AA meeting. You know? She would be the speaker, of course, you know? She was a little character. I remember one time she was busy playing or something, and Hopalong Cassidy was on TV, and she ran with the orange juice, poured it down the TV, and the house, you know, the orange just went up in flames, and her father rushed in there and said, young lady, what do you think I ought to do about that? She said, if you got good sense, you'll get me out of here. He did. She's just always interesting. But anyway, she grew up, and she's the one where I found the Bibles in her closet, and I remember saying, Peter, you got to talk to her. You got to talk to her. And Peter wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it, you know. And then I had to say, well, you know, I can't do much about it. But then she came to me and she said, there's something I ought to tell you about myself. And I said, oh, this is it. This is it. This is my chance to be the mother of the year, you know. She said, I am going to be pregnant, right? No. She said, I am gay. And I said, not in my house. Not in my house. You know? And Lisa left. She lived in Philadelphia for a while. And the phone would ring, and I would run to the phone to see if it was Lisa, because we didn't know where she was. She lived in San Francisco for a while, and the phone would ring, and I'd run, and it wasn't Lisa. She lived in Boise, Idaho. She lived all geographic cures around the country. And one day she called and she said, Mom, I need to come home and I need to bring my friend and I'm suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And my sponsor said, you read 448 in the big book and you read it every day. And I said, come on home, Lisa. And Lisa got on that plane and she and her friend, and you have never seen such a sad looking group. Those two coming home to rest in Virginia. And Peter and I were there and we just opened our arms, and Lisa came home and they moved into the family room in our house, and Lisa got sober. Lisa in July celebrated 20 years of sobriety. And so did Nancy. So did Nancy. Lisa's a joy in my life. She's quite an achiever and she's done a whole lot of stuff. And she's always remodeling herself in some new career, you know. The shock of all shocks was just recently she called me and said, Mama, I'm getting married to a man. And I said, huh? You know. So I flew into Washington to spend a little time with her, and I met her husband and future husband, and I've never seen two people so much in love. They just love one another. They're really into church stuff, and I'm one of those people who, I belong to so many churches, I think when they see me coming down the aisle, they kind of run away. Because Peter and I used to join, we join, our recovery has come in these rooms. I just love God. Just love God, you know. And every once in a while, I have this urge. I want to go back and celebrate with them. I want to hear them sing the hymns. I just love all that. But dance with the one that brung you. And for me, it's been these rooms. You know. I got to go to be with Lisa when she got married. My oldest son came, and Lisa, Alma, my middle child, and we just celebrated. Lisa was so just, I've never seen a young woman so happy. And I had this real strange thing because I also love Nancy. That's because of you. Nancy's still a part of my life. Not a part of Lisa's life anymore. But I don't want to be in the way with Lisa because she's got this new relationship. So you can't have the family, everybody come together, and I invite Nancy, and Lisa's got her new husband there. You know, it's kind of weird. But you know what? I'm going to pray that through because I believe God's going to fix the way. You know, and I still talk to Nancy because she calls every once in a while. Because she was with us through some real trials in our life. And I'm celebrating with Lisa. She's going through a real crisis now. Her husband of two has cancer. And she's really worried about him. But she's trusting God because you taught her how to do that. She's turning it over on a daily day basis. And she's working a program. And she's going to her church thing. And she's doing everything Lisa can do at this point to stand on her own two feet. You know? And you know what? Lisa's going to be okay. You know why? Because you told me so. You said, as long as I keep my hands off of her and keep saying it's not my business and I just love you. And I can do that without any problem. I just love you, Lisa. You know? Then Alma. Alma's my middle child. Alma's a child. My mother used to say, I hope you never have a child just like you. Or maybe she said it the other way. Anyway, I got her. Alma's child, I remember hitting her little butt when she was little, and she said, it's too bad a big lady like you has to hit a little girl like me. Yeah. She was just a little terror, you know? I mean, she was I remember she kept poor Lisa. She would just, I remember biting Lisa. She was just doing terrible. She was always in something, painting the walls in the bedroom with toilet stuff and just always doing something. You know, it was just like, well, one of the problems, Alma's smarter than I am. It's not easy to rear a child who's smarter than you. And I mean, she could just kind of sit there and maneuver. Let me see how I can get her in a tizzy, you know? Let me see. Well, when I started working my program, she couldn't do it. You know, she said, the old girl has changed. And then we were in upstate New York. We're doing fine. Now, Peter's got this great job. We moved to the Washington area. He's going to work with the Carter administration. We got the big house. We're doing good. And you know what? They didn't have a health care program. And Peter lost his job. And we were working our programs. And God, life, God didn't do that. Life stripped everything away from us that we had. You know, we lost a house, we lost a big car, couldn't have help anymore, had to get a job myself, went out to work, we got on food stamps. Nobody in my family had been on food stamps, you know. I remember going up to visit my stepmother and kind of hiding the food stamps because I was getting something out of the store for her. But you know, that was the best time in our life. God took away things and gave us grace. He helped us. We loved one another through that time. We knew this program would work. People would call and have little mini problems, as Peter said, and we would talk to them and we'd feel better. We were sponsoring more people and we felt better, you know? We were telling what we learned in these rooms and we felt better. Well, Aunt Alma was going away to college, and she, I got this job, and I was saving my money to, you know, I was going to pay her because we said we were going to give her this, her tuition. And she came home one day and said she changed her mind. She wasn't going to go to college anymore, that she had found her niche in life, and she was going to be a waitress. Nothing wrong with being a waitress, but this child has an IQ that goes off the, you know. But she said that she thought there was some mystery in waiting tables. She never cleaned the table at home, you know. So we went to the restaurant. We said, just be a good waitress. We went to the restaurant. I've never seen a waitress like that in my life. She was just terrible. I mean, she brought the wrong food. And I said, I didn't order this, Alma. She said, eat it anyway. The man at the table next to me said, this is the worst waitress I have ever had in my life. Alma said, you want better service? Go to a better place. You know? That's my Alma. You know, just, I remember one time she came home and she said, this program just worked. This program worked. She said, I'm bringing home this boyfriend, and she said, I just want to see your approval, you know. And fine, you know, she brought him home, and he was the same age as Peter. Only he didn't have a job, so he kind of reminded you of Peter if he had never come to the program, you know. We took him out to dinner, and we just had a wonderful time. And, you know, Peter and I just said, we were just gracious. We were loving. We were gracious. And, you know, and Alma drove off. No, they walked off because they didn't have a car. They walked off into the sunset together, and we were so nice. And there was this car right in front of us that live and let live, the bump sticker, you know. And, you know, that relationship didn't last long. And you know why? Because we didn't say anything. We got out of the way and let Alma have her experience. She was standing at a bus stop and a man put a knife in Alma's neck and dragged her off into an alley and raped her. And you had helped me come through my experiences so I could go to be with Alma and just hold her and love her. Just love her. And let her realize that she wasn't at fault. She had done nothing. And we watched Alma grow through that experience. She went back to college. She got her undergraduate degree and then went on and got her master's in theology. And we watched Alma some 10 years ago when she was ordained in the United Church of Christ. And Alma is a preacher like I had not heard before. Of course, I'm a little prejudiced. But she is a great preacher. She's a theologian. She's deep, you know. I'm just here. She's down here, you know. And I sit at her feet, and she'll explain something to me, and I say, wow, boy, I never looked at that scripture this way or that way and so forth. Also, Alma's gay. When she told me, I said, who cares? You know. She's got a partner, and they pastor a church in Chicago. And 2 years ago, they adopted the light of my life, little Lisa. You know, that child is just a blessing. You know? She has a light about her and a confidence in her that I don't remember ever having. I mean, she just walks in like she owns it, you know? And she kind of pats me on the head, and she says, she calls me Zaba. She says, Zaba's old, you know? And I'm down on the floor playing with her, and she just kind of feels sorry, Zaba, you know? And she helps me up, you know? And we look at Barney together, and we discuss it philosophically. You know, her mother and partner won't look at these things with me. So we just sit there and we talk about Barney's good points and his bad, you know. We talk about Teletubbies, and I'm authority on those things. I mean, I'm good at that. You know, we're having a great time. And then 4 years ago, Alma had had surgery, and Lisa had had surgery, and Peter was sick. I got a call and said I needed to come home. I was visiting Alma, and the call said that David was sick. David's my youngest child. David's the joy. David, when they put that baby in my arms, it was like God saying, okay, I'm giving you back your son. You know, and I had David. And David was a joy. David was so much fun. David was, I remember pushing him in a cart, and the lady said, you are the prettiest baby I've ever seen in my life. And he said, you're the strangest looking lady. This David, you know. He was a gifted singer. He was a musician. He was weird. But he was our David, you know. I remember one night I got a call, and David said, Mama, I'm in a bar. And he said, I'm drunk. I don't even know my name. He said, a man came out of the stall and said, young man, you don't have to live like that. I'm going to take you to a 12-step meeting. In a bar. Somebody 12-stepped my son and took him to a meeting. What if I had not let him go? What if I had been in there maneuvering, trying to say, don't do this and don't do that? What if I had been doing all the stuff I thought parents were supposed to do before I came in these rooms? But I let David be David. And he took him to a meeting. About 10 years ago, David told us that he was suffering from HIV. David, too, is gay. Maybe it's genetic. I'm quite getting it. But anyway. I came home, and for 4 days we stayed in the hospital with David. I remember getting to the hospital, and David said, Mama, is this the time? And I didn't know at that point. And a little later on, I remember sitting with him, and he said, Mama, is this the time? And I said, yes. Yes. And David said, you know, Mama, if God loves me, he's not going to leave me in this pain, is he? No. And he said, Mama, if I could have loved anyone one-tenth as much as you've loved me, it would have been more than enough. Thank you, David. And he said, isn't it good I worked out the relationship with me and my dad? I said, oh, yeah, David. He said, isn't it good that Alma and Lisa and I are so close? And they came in and they increased the morphine. And I held his hand and his sisters and his brother. We all were around. We sang hymns. And Lisa prayed and Alma prayed. And I took his hand and I said, David. He looked at me and I said, David, it's okay to leave us. And David left. David left. But David is very much a part of my life every day. I'm at meetings and some young man will come up and hug me and I'll see David, you know. Or I'm talking to somebody somewhere and I see David, you know. He just can't really go too far from us because I don't think when you love somebody as much as we love David that the chain or the tie ever is broken. And so I know I'll see David again, you know. 2 years ago, Peter got sick. And we talked. We talked a lot. We'd sit in the room and talk about recovery. We talked about where we came from. We talked about this program and the transformation in our life. We talked about living in that one-bedroom apartment when the bed would fall out of the wall, you know, anytime it wanted to, you know. We talked about trying to sell pop bottles to get enough money to go to work, you know. We talked about all kinds of things, and then we talked about God's grace. We talked about the dimensions of God's love. We talked about the healing that happens in these rooms. We talked about the fact that eternal life began the day my husband got sober. That's when it started. It started when you people started saying to him, I love you, and he began to love himself. And then he was able to love us. And I began, because of people like you, able to love him unconditionally. And you know, we both could stand on our own two feet. You know, that's the miracle. And we stood around Peter's bed, you know, and I held his hand. And Lisa read a scripture. And Elma said a prayer. And I got to say, Peter, it's okay. It's okay. You can go. You know, what a privilege. What a privilege to be with those people you love the most when they cross from here to there. When Peter got to the hospice the first time, he got to the hospice and he looked over and he said, Dawn, there's David standing over there waiting for me. And I said, where, honey? He said, he's in the corner. Don't you see him? You know? See, I don't know. I'm not deep like that. I don't understand the mysteries of life and death. But I know that Peter saw David in the corner at that room, and that gives me the understanding I'll see them again. So what am I doing now? I'm living my life, you know? I'm working my program. I'm trusting God. I'm going to meetings. I'm sponsoring people. I just hired some guy to help me with my exercise, because I've become a slob since Peter died. I'm not walking anymore. And so I've got a personal trainer, you know? I bought a condo in Chicago. I'm living well. I'm living well because of this program. Some days I miss Peter so much, I think my heart would break. But on the other side of that, I have all this gratitude. And I can't come, they just come together, and I fill with praise and hope and joy. So I don't know where you are in this program. I don't know what your story is. I don't know whether you suffer from terminal uniqueness. I don't know whether you think your case is worse than any case that's possible. I don't know. But I do know that if this program could put two broken people like Peter and I together and work out that dysfunctional marriage and turn it into a song of joy, God can do anything. If God brought you here this morning and you're sitting in these chairs, God has something in store for you. And I don't care what you've done in your life, nothing. Nothing is beyond God's healing grace. It's all forgiven through those steps. So don't close your heart. Open it to the joy. Open it to recovery. The program works. God bless you.